This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right, a company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces. Hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com. All right. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Pod Staff. With me today, I have Mr. Cam Wanick. Cam, thank you for being here.
Dude, thanks for having me, Michael.
So Cam is my best friend. We met a couple of years ago at work. Whenever we're doing some tech healthcare staffing sales. But Cam has a longer sales career. He started in logistics. He then went to the inside sales doing that healthcare technology. And now he is in pharma sales doing outside sales. So Cam, thanks for being here, and I'll let you give a little background of yourself.
Yeah, thanks again for having me, Michael. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
It's good to be on. Yeah, so I've been in sales for give or take 8 years now. Coming out of college, I went into the logistics field at a 3PL. There were pros and cons to that industry. I would definitely say there's a good amount of money to be made, and there's a lot of opportunity when it comes to the amount of margin that those companies can take in, but it's a little, I don't want to say sleazy, but
it is sleazy, though.
It can get a little bit cutthroat,
yeah,
in those types of companies.
Yeah. Well, and I think
saw it firsthand.
You also mentioned that some of the leadership and stuff like that, you know, not everyone, but there was a lot of people who didn't really care about the people.
Yeah.
And I think that's true everywhere.
Yeah.
But I just remember you specifically telling me that about logistics.
Yeah. So. And my specific leader who I reported to at the end of my tenure, I looked up to him as a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he was a great person. So to your point, it's not everyone, but from a bigger picture, I'm glad I got to start my career in the industry. It taught me a lot of hustle and how to get things done.
Yeah.
But leaving was definitely very good for me.
Yeah.
Progression,
I can see that. Yeah, for sure. And then, so after that, you went to the company that we met at, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
So talk to us about that.
Yeah, I think all in all, I took a step up going from company to company. It was a bigger company, a lot more structure. I mean, you can speak to that too. A lot more solid leadership
mm-hmm.
at that company. I just don't think that industry was for me, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not for everyone, especially anything involving staffing is certainly, I think a lot of our listeners, especially our young listeners out there, have done some sort of recruiting or staffing or, you know, anything like that. And while you can make a lot of money doing it, it's not for everyone.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and I think another thing about that, just the staffing industry, where, you know, even though I'm someone who would tend to enjoy that challenge,
mm-hmm.
I think something that a lot of people don't talk about in the staffing industry is how you can sell well, you can, especially if you're doing client sales,
mm-hmm.
and you're selling like a platform or something like that, you can do really well at your job,
mm-hmm.
right? But then you're still banking on other people, the
yep.
staff members that you're recruiting or placing or, you know, whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
to show up on time, to show up at all, to do a good job. So there's all these factors. And then there's factors of weather, you know, there's factors of, you know, what's my challenge of getting to the job? Is my kid sick at the last minute?
Mm-hmm.
Things like that. So I think it's a super challenging industry. And I definitely, for your sake, I'm glad that you kind of moved on to something else because it seems like you
yeah.
really like your job now. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I would kind of to touch back on what you were saying. I
yeah.
think the biggest thing for me was realizing I do a really good job of selling myself.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in that industry that company we were at together, it was hard to sell yourself because really what you were selling was the product, the technology.
Mm-hmm.
And the uncontrollables are just that, they're uncontrollables.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I can see it both ways, right? Because I feel like in my time, you know, in that industry, I think I was able to sell myself well, and so were you. But
mm-hmm.
You're selling yourself to the client instead of, you know, what really matters to the client is the care that's being provided or is the staff members that are coming, are they reliable? Are they quality? things like that. And a lot of times they are. I'm not saying they're not.
Yeah. Okay.
It's just when they're not, it certainly is something that you feel on the sales and account management end.
Yeah. I remember specific instances feeling in my head, I can't confidently be honest here.
Yeah.
Now, the products are the products.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors that I'm selling to like and use these products every day, whether they care to admit it or not. And I'm not having to give them a pitch, really. It's just detailing them what it is and asking, hey, do you think this is something you'd use?
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are direct are easy to sell to because they're like, yeah, I'm interested, tell me more, or no, I wouldn't use that. And it's a quick little pivot to something else.
Yeah, so you're kind of, you know, your product is your product, like you said.
Yeah.
And I think that is very different from the last industry because while I am, you know, partial to just, I had a good amount of success in the other industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
So even though it's challenging, I think I kind of liked that unknown at some points just because, I don't know, sometimes the unknown is scary, but if you come out on the other side of it, I think that's the main thing. Then you're like, oh, hell yeah, let me do that again, and let me do that again and again. Whereas I think what fits better for you is just that product. Like, you study your product. I remember whenever you first started this job, you studied your product. You were super excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
You gave me a few samples to, you know, test on, you know, my eyes and my dad's eyes and stuff like that just because you wanted to see our opinion on the product. So I think that was a lot more aligned probably with you and just having that kind of, here's what it is, go out there and bring us back some more accounts or do more sales or, you know, whatever it may mm-hmm. be. Am I correct? And
you're spot on.
Yeah.
And the biggest thing to take away from what you're saying is it's tangible.
Mm-hmm.
You can hold it, see it, feel it. Like when I'm going into these clinics and I'm going to these accounts, I'm bringing in a bag. They call it a rep bag.
Yeah.
And you fill it with the products. So I can whip it out, show them, be like, hey, do you want to hold this? Here, we have this is one of our dry mask products. Here, feel it. See how we have the stitching and X, Y, and Z and all like the intricacies of it. But that leads me to thinking this industry, it might not just be the industry that I'm more into. It's the face-to-face selling
mm-hmm.
versus the over-the-phone selling.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I wanted to get into is like, let's put the products aside. Let's mm-hmm. put whether it's a technology, software as a service, an actual tangible product like you're selling now.
Mm-hmm.
That aside, going from that, you know, two jobs where you were doing inside sales to immediately jumping into pharma where all you're doing is face-to-face sales.
Mm-hmm.
How was that transition and what do you think you like about each of those differences?
What did I like about cold calling? Nothing, I'll be honest. Didn't like any of it.
Yeah.
What I liked with inside sales was once I brought on a new client, I felt that I was always good about building a good relationship from there on out.
You like the account management
yes,
piece.
I really did. When it comes to outside face-to-face sales, oh my God, I just feel like I can be myself.
Yeah.
It's much easier just to walk in to an account with confidence, knowing I'm gonna leave with either a better understanding of how I can help them or some business.
Mm-hmm.
As long as I'm leaving with one of those two.
Right, yeah, and I feel like your personality, like I would define you, I think you would agree, as a true extrovert.
Mm-hmm.
Like you recharge around people, around things that are just, you know, going on, fun things, any conversations. Doesn't have to be a night out. It could be a work conversation in person. Whereas someone like me, I like to have a balance in between because I would say I'm a really good extrovert. But I had to learn about myself a few years ago that I am an introvert that's really good at being extrovert. So I wanted to just kind of get into pharma sales, mm-hmm. pharmaceutical sales.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very broad term, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I've watched documentaries where, you know, all these drugs were coming out. I think it was in the 90s or the early 2000s where they were not good for you. People were getting hooked on them.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of like the pharma stigma where people were going out and selling medicine,
mm-hmm.
right? And then it kind of took my professional career to realize that pharmaceutical sales could be any sort of product, but I don't know all the details about it. So
yeah.
Can you kind of define that?
Yeah. From a broad perspective, what I've been able to grasp is what my company is selling pharmaceutical-wise is not like a McKesson or Stryker where they're in
niches
of healthcare where a lot of the products and medicines that they're making are life or death. My company, it's eye care. Like there are emergency surgeries that we are helping and dealing with, but the worst case scenario is someone loses an eye. You're not gonna be put into a hospital and die over anything that the doctors that I talk to are dealing with.
Right, yeah.
So it's a little bit less intense. Where we fit into pharmaceutical sales is our compounding pharmacy is taking different drugs to mesh it into eyelid cleanser sprays.
Right. So it's still drugs.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It's drugs that are used for different purposes mm-hmm. other than swallowing or, swallowing or injecting, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And there are some of our competitors that do have drugs like that,
mm-hmm.
but I think it really is how you pitch it to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Every doctor is going to have their preference of how they like to treat, whether they like to do an oral medicine, a topical spray, or an eye drop that they want to put in the eye. Are all three effective? Yeah, they can be.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's just finding, and this goes back to just the selling aspect of understanding your client from the get-go is like, okay, which of these doctors at this one account is going to be on board with what I have to offer, and how can I use them to influence the other doctors? Because
mm-hmm.
truthfully, I'm not going to change a doctor's mind on how they've been treating someone for the past 15, 20 years.
Yeah, at least not in one or two conversations,
no.
right? It would have to be someone that they deem, unfortunately, you know, if I was a doctor and I had a salesperson try to tell me something versus a peer doctor that I had for the last decade mm-hmm. said, man, I know this is a sales guy, but he's onto something. Like mm-hmm. he actually is really good. Mm-hmm. I think it's just building that credibility probably.
Oh yeah. And you want to get on their side to where they like you enough to trust you to try something.
Yeah.
Cause all these other reps all have good products.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest. Like that's where I've learned to come in and not down talk the competition. I've never tried to be like, oh, that drug isn't useful for X, Y, and Z. Cause truthfully, if I try to come across to the doctor like I know more than them, odds are they're going to, you know, call my bluff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in any industry, I would say most, I know some, I'm sure it's different in logistics, but I would say it's probably just a generally good practice when you're in sales to not bash your competition to mm-hmm. your prospects or to your current clients. I think that there's ways to do that too.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think there's ways to try to show how you have a leg up but still be an honorable salesman. Because I think the sales industry, a lot of people, myself included growing up, I kind of was like, oh, well, yeah, most salesmen are going to be like kind of trying to pull a fast one on you or kind of that used car salesman stigma that everyone has.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But what I've realized is whenever you become more of a mature salesman, you can start to view the prospect or the client as like a patient, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you start to diagnose all of these things. In sales, everyone calls them pain points, right? You start to diagnose these pain points and it leads you ultimately to showing them how your product or your service would affect their business and it would affect their end user results. That could be, you know, a patient in a nursing home. It could be a patient at a doctor's office. It could be mm-hmm. someone having surgery,
mm-hmm.
anything like that. But I think the best salesmen I've been around have been the ones that treat the person first and the person's pain points instead of just trying to say, hey, here's the best product. It's like, no, how can I get my product to better serve you
mm-hmm.
than your other competitors would? Exactly. And I think that's where the human aspect comes in. And mm-hmm. that's where if you can gain that trust, you're able to show the effort that they appreciate in right. a lot of cases.
Right. And to your point, there's a good way and a bad way of going about doing that. Doctors are going to have their protocols, and when it comes to talking about other competition and other drugs out there, a lot of the times, if you're just asking the open-ended question of, okay, so you're trying to cure this specific disease, this lid disease we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
they're dead set on, oh no, I've just been using blank product. works in 30 days. It helps fix this.
Yeah, it's not broke, so why would you fix it?
So the biggest thing that I've found is successful in doing is getting the doctors to understand, okay, well, they can still use the drug that I have in conjunction with what they're already doing to give the patient a better result.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting too, because I think a lot of people think that you can only use one company, or like you have to be loyal to... I'm all for brand loyalty, but why not multiple brands? If they all do something different for you, why not be loyal to three brands instead of just one, right? And I think that's where a lot of salespeople go wrong, and a lot of account managers specifically go wrong, because instead of, you know, saying... my product's good, their product's good, they're just good in different ways. I think a lot of people try to grab all the business, which ultimately doesn't always give the most successful result for the client. And I think that's where the compassion and the being a salesman who really cares about the people and the end users comes into play.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. I actually had a conversation with a client a couple weeks ago about how I flat out told her, I think it's important to have multiple vendors. You should. You should have multiple options for your patients.
Right.
And I think she, leading that conversation, she actually had a little bit more respect. Like, okay, like, yeah, he's coming in trying to sell me.
Well, this isn't something she hears every day.
Right.
Yeah.
Because most of them, most of your, in any sales capacity, most of your clients are just hearing the different reps or different sales reps pitch their company and shove their company down their throat.
Right.
When sometimes it's okay to just... acknowledge, like, hey, I understand you have other companies that are competitors of mine. You might like those individual representatives, and you might like their products.
Yeah.
So don't stop using them.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Moving into our next segment, though, I want to get into kind of like lifestyle topics, right? Like wellness and how that also ties in with your career, right? Because just knowing you, you're a guy who knows moderation well. And I know you've had times that you haven't done it well, but the guy I know now knows moderation very well. I think that's something that I struggle with a lot. I tend to be an all or nothing type guy. But you still work out 5-6 days a week, right? You still work 9 hours a day. You still make time for your family. You make time for your friends. You make time for doing stuff like a podcast. And then you also make time to go out and have a good night with your buddies in Dallas or something, you know? So I think I'd like to hear a little bit about your moderation strategy and how you kind of came to that conclusion.
Yeah. I think when it all comes down to it is you have to have balance with everything that you're doing, whether it's your fitness, health, wellness, friendships, family, work, alone time, recharging. All of it has to have a piece of it. Of itself and a bit of each in your life. When it comes to moderation, though, I'll be the first to say I'm pretty disciplined when it comes to my diet, but it's okay to not have the discipline sometimes. Like the past 2 weeks, right around the holidays, oh man, I've pigged out.
Yeah.
And years ago in my early 20s, I would probably make myself feel so guilty. I would be beating myself up. But I've learned to just be like, it's okay. It's not the end of the world.
Yeah.
Just get back on the grind that I was on, and you get back to yourself.
Yeah, it's kind of like having those reset moments. We talked about that a little bit with, like, even, you know, coming off a sickness or coming off a night out with friends or something like that. I think it doesn't have to drag into more days than it needs to. Sure, it might take out a day or something like that if you're coming off a sickness, but having that base of here's how I reset, whether it's a workout, whether it's coupled with other things, whether it's your diet, whether it's coffee, whether it's mud water. I know you like your mud water. But yeah, I think that's something that a lot of us struggle with. And I don't know, what's your best advice to someone who logically knows what moderation is, but may not have the tools to implement it correctly, consistently as well in their life?
Start small. Start small. You're not going to go from not working out, lifting weights ever to 5-6 times a week. You need to just take a baby step and say, okay, I'm going to start doing two workouts a week, or I'm just going to go outside and do an hour walk mm-hmm. two times a week. And that will eventually, like, it sounds so cliche because people probably say this all the time, but it will build. One good meal turns into one good workout, and it'll snowball into you being like, okay, I want to do this more, because you're going to feel good. When you do veer off and overindulge, and whether it's partying or, you know, eating sweets, overeating, not getting enough sleep, all those things make you feel like crap. Mm-hmm. And when you get back to what you need to do, you just, it all falls back into place.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's been a huge thing for me, at least the exercise piece. You know, I'm a 5-6 day a week gym guy as well. And it doesn't always have to be 2 hours in the gym. You know, I have a 2-hour workout once a week with this guy right here. Mm-hmm. Other than that, you know, I go to, you know, I work, do sauna workouts where I do cycling and stuff like that. And I lift for 30 to 45 minutes some days, or maybe I go on an hour long walk. But I think what I realized for myself is, yes, it's great to have, you know, the physical strength and, you know, the benefits of maybe losing some weight and stuff like that. But the overarching result for my drive really for the exercise a lot is the mental aspect. Mm-hmm. I know for myself, no matter what I've been doing for, you know, the last week or whatever, if I go more than 3 days without working out, maybe that might even be pushing it, I notice a huge difference in my probably my dopamine, how much enjoyment am I getting out of life, mm-hmm. My cortisol levels, how stressed I am, stuff like that. And I feel like if you can get to a place where for your mental, you're working out once a day, twice a week, wherever you start, right? If you get to that place and you get to say those days, the hardest thing I'm going to do today is exercise. Like, this workout is going to be the hardest thing I do today. Doesn't that make everything a little bit easier?
I think the biggest thing for most people is you have to find what you actually enjoy doing. Being active, but also fun things that you actually like to do.
Yeah, pickleball, golf, you know, things like that.
It's crazy. Back when I was in my early 20s, I would go for more bike rides. Just because at that point in my life, it was more accessible. Like, I, you know, was right by a bike trail, and for whatever reason. Now, I go for more walks just because I'm starting to find that it brings me more calmness in my mind, mm-hmm. and I enjoy it.
Well, there's studies about going on walks mm-hmm. too, bike riding as well, but like therapeutic studies to where our brains can act as filing cabinets, right? So our brain, when we go on a walk, if we're just all wound up and we think, what's a walk going to do? I used to think that too. I've never, ever, ever once got back from a long walk and been like, oh, I feel so much worse. I may not feel great, mm-hmm. but I always feel better to some degree. If not, you know, much better. Because whenever you're walking, I think it has to do, I don't know the exact science behind it, but I think it has something to do with, you know, the right foot, left foot, whether that's walking or pedaling. Mm-hmm. It kind of does something in sync with your mind to where your mind's able to say, this over here, this over here, and kind of that filing cabinet approach. And that's something that I learned whenever I was working on my mental health about 4 years ago. And I didn't know how to cope with things. I didn't know how to, I didn't really know what general wellness was, to be mm-hmm. honest with you. Mm-hmm. And when I started learning those little tricks, it's different for everyone. But for me, when I started to learn those little tricks, it ended up snowballing into something really good, whereas before I was having a lot of snowballs into something really bad. So I think it's got to look different for everyone, but it's certainly necessary to get that exercise in.
Yeah, I think back to the walk thing versus the bike ride thing, mm-hmm. they're both great forms of exercise. You're probably going to get more bang for your buck burning calories wise doing a bike ride, but to what you were just talking about, the walk to me slows you down mm-hmm. mentally. And it allows you to have time to process, be in your thoughts, and actually calm yourself down and be more relaxed afterward. And that should be the whole reason that you eat right, get good sleep, stay consistent with your workouts, is so that you feel better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Before we move on, That is a hell of a watch you've got on. Is that a tin can timepiece?
That it is, Michael. Hell yeah.
I happen to have a tin can timepiece on as well. And this is the Swiss SS1. This has a Sellita movement in it, which is the same that's in Tudor and entry-level Rolexes. And this is the Quartermaster in teal. I think this is a really good podcasting watch because it pops from a distance.
It really does, actually. It kind of stands out. Especially, and I will say, Michael can vouch for me. Not a watch guy.
No.
I never wear watches.
Never.
This might convince me to start wearing some watches.
Hey, when I put that on him, he said, how much is this?
Like, okay, I might.
Which, to be fair, that's a Swiss watch. It's got a Swiss movement. Like I said, a Sellita movement in there. And that price point is under $500. I think it's $449. So, and then with the PodStaff20 code, you can use PodStaff20, you can use Michael20. You'll get 20% off your entire order. All right, moving on past, you know, the just the overall drive in life, the sales stuff, the career stuff. I do want to get into kind of your relationship journey with, you know, any significant others in your life. And then the faith as well. But before we move to the faith, I definitely would like to know, are there like must-haves in relationships that are basically non-negotiables? Like that you have, through trial and error in relationships, said that quality, can't do it. Doesn't matter how beautiful they are. Doesn't matter how awesome they are in other ways. If they have that or they don't have that, I can't have it.
I would go as far to put it as simply as this. I don't think there's any must-haves for me at this point. It's more or less the mindset of, do I want to make this work with the other person? And both people in the relationship have to think that.
I think that's a very interesting take, that because you would think that a lot of people would have must-haves. Shoot, my question was about must-haves. But I have heard people say before, like on podcasts and, you know, social media and just, you know, self-help people or therapists, they'll say it's really usually not, there's some things that have to align, right? Like for me, I would like my faith to align with their faith, and, you know, goals for having kids and stuff like that. I feel like past those though, it's more so deciding. It's not just, can this work? Oh, I hope it does. I think it's more deciding, am I willing to make this work? And if both people are, it usually is going to work. Right?
100%. I couldn't agree more. Because I've been in my past relationships, I've been in three like genuine long-term relationships. And all three of those people, their love languages were very different. But at the end of the day, like, do you have your preferences? Maybe. But it's just a matter of, do I want to go the extra mile to make this person feel loved? And do I want to be able to communicate with this person what I do need in order to be loved? And are they capable of doing that?
Yeah, so I think kind of what I gathered from that is, it's, am I willing to meet them where they're at in their love language? Are they willing to meet me where I'm at in my love language? Because for me, I'm a big, I think we all have multiple, but I'm a big acts of service guy, to where if I know that you like went the extra mile to like go pick something up, or like you cleaned, or you did, it could be anything. But if I know that you did something to relieve me of having to do that, or maybe you just did it because you wanted to see me smile, that makes me incredibly happy. But some people are more, all I need is like hugs and kisses throughout the day. Some people are more, yeah, if you give me gifts often, you know, I think that's more of a shallow one.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
There are people like that, right?
I'm not a big gift giver or getter.
Yeah.
But I think for me, quality time is a big one. But I also have understood as I've matured and gotten older, you can't have everything and all things in that love language. There needs to be space too. Like, I want quality time, but all that, with all that being said, I understand that there needs to be time away as well. And there needs to be space. So when it comes to like people who are really into physical touch, like that's their biggest love language, you can't always be in contact with each other.
Right.
Like there gets to a point where it could be too much for the other person. And you have to kind of acknowledge that and see that.
Yeah, and I think, and we'll get to the, you know, the family stuff in a bit, but I think you've had an incredible model for that. So whereas some people's standards for a relationship is here, yours is probably here. And there's nothing wrong with that, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's what you've seen. That's what you know. You've seen it work. It's very successful. There's a lot of love, you know, all that good stuff. And I think whenever you're fortunate enough to be around that model, then you're going to be probably a little bit more picky in mm-hmm. your selection of your life partner, mm-hmm. right?
I will say this. I think I am very blessed that I was able to be raised by a mom and a dad that loved each other a lot and made things work. Mm-hmm. When in a lot of cases, they didn't necessarily agree on the type of style they wanted to do parenting-wise, how they wanted to portray a message, but there was compromise. And I learned that at a young age, that's how you have to make it work.
Yeah, I feel like from what I know about you and your family, there have been a lot of times when it didn't have to go that well, mm-hmm. right? Like you moved from New Jersey, the East Coast, mm-hmm. down to Texas. I mean, that's a huge transition. The way that, you know, you've put it to me in the past, your whole family moved down as a collective unit. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's overly common to see, like, families, because you're the oldest, you've got a middle brother, you've got a youngest brother, mm-hmm. and then your family, too, your parents. Y'all are all in different stages of life, yet you decided together, we're going to move as a unit. And I think that that's very rare. I think it's very special. But I'd like to hear about some of the challenges with that move were, and then maybe just kind of how important the family aspect is to you. Mm-hmm.
I do want to just say, can you believe it's almost been 10 years?
Yeah, that's wild.
This August will be 10 years since we lived in Dallas now, so it feels like I'm a true Texan at this point.
Yeah.
But...
Yeehaw.
I won't say that. But what I will say, it was a big culture shock. The Southern hospitality mm-hmm. is real. Most of the people that you interact with up in the Northeast are very direct and a little bit rude sometimes. But I kind of thrived off that. I kind of liked it.
Yeah. Well, and my family, my mom's side of the family is all from Philly and New Jersey and just all over Pennsylvania. And yeah, I mean, when you get around Philly and those areas, there's a lot of directness. But I think when you get past those layers, they're not as hospitable up front, right? But they are a lot of times extremely good people mm-hmm. that just kind of want to skip the BS mm-hmm. and go into like a meaningful conversation, right? Mm-hmm. Or they just want to get down to the point.
Exactly.
And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, but I'm sure that having that as your daily whenever you were growing up and then coming down to Texas and people are scared to tell you that you have something on your face, mm-hmm. you know, because they don't want to offend you. They're scared to say, hey, excuse me. That's the extreme.
Yeah.
But other than that, you know, just people being very friendly in general.
And if I'm being honest, that type of mentality kind of pissed me off when I first moved here.
Yeah.
But I learned to understand and be more empathetic towards, okay, like there can be a middle ground.
Yeah.
Like I can still be myself, but be a little bit more hospitable and come across with a little bit more grace.
I think honestly, we've worked on that together for you as well. You know, like, I think that it's a bonus that I have the Texas gene in me and I have the Northeastern gene in me as well, mm-hmm. because I think that there's a good balance. And I think you found that balance now too. Mm-hmm. Whereas like you can be brutally honest with people, but meet them with grace. Cause I like to quote, honesty without compassion is cruelty mm-hmm. a lot of times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I do want to hear about kind of your, for lack of a better term, maybe non-negotiable family rituals that no matter how busy your life gets, no matter how busy work gets, no matter what's going on, it seems like you have a lot of those rituals in place or just time to spend quality time with your family mm-hmm. where y'all are all together, that you wouldn't trade that for the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say when we first moved to Texas, it was a big change, just culturally, the different types of people that were around. But the biggest thing was, I think for me and my brothers, it helped us kind of grow up into understanding like you're going to move into life and be on your own. but you want to have family always be there. It helps that we're all close, not just emotionally, but physically.
Right.
We all live within a 20, 30 minute drive. Mm-hmm. So to be able to do these rituals on a weekly cadence is easy to do.
Yeah, but
if you stick to it.
Right, because I think there's plenty of people who grew up around here, their family lives around here, and they don't see them but once a month, mm-hmm. right? Whereas you, I don't know, there's been many weeks where you've said, yeah, I didn't see my family this week. And I think that, you know, even though that's the norm for you, mm-hmm. what I recognize is that that's very important to you. And I think even though I haven't been around your family that much, there's the times that I have, there is a tight-knitness about y'all's unit together, your mm-hmm. collective family unit, where there's a lot of love, there's a lot of respect, there's a lot of tough love going on. But I think there's also kudos to your parents as well, because they have created a welcoming environment for you to bring any type of person around, for you to bring any type of issue to them mm-hmm. and see and meet you where you are, instead of a lot of people's parents. You know, I think it's very easy for a parent to say, you can tell me anything. Okay, but what's your reaction going to be whenever I tell you that? How are you going to receive that information?
Mm-hmm. I do want to give my parents a kudos, because they have been wonderful in laying down a blueprint for me to understand, okay, this is how I want to parent one day. This is mm-hmm. how I want to be seen as a father, and how I want to raise my kids. But the truth of the matter is, Michael, what it comes down to is, as an individual, you have to mature and realize it's okay to have these tough conversations. It's important. You need to have these tough conversations. Because back to what you were just talking about, how in some households, they might not, the kids or the family might not feel comfortable answering certain questions with their parents, if that's mm-hmm. kind of what you're getting at. I didn't have those open and honest conversations with my parents in my early 20s and my late teens. It wasn't until I was like 24, 25, where I myself just became comfortable with it. Because mm-hmm. I started telling myself in my head, it's not the situation or how my parents are going to react, it's how I internally feel about it.
Right. For lack of a better term, I guess, maybe it's certain levels of trust that were built over time.
Right.
To where you felt comfortable to be able to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that's interesting as well. Like, I feel like a lot of people have given up on the trust, whether it's relationships, families, anything like that, to where they feel like it's too far gone. Mm-hmm. Like, do you ever think that there's cases where it really is too far gone?
I mean, I have people in my family that, yeah. that we view it as that.
Yeah.
Because there is. There is an extent. There is a level that you can hit to where the trust is gone. Back to what you said earlier, the trust is gone. There's people that I've had in my life that I will no longer, if they reach out to me, I'm not going to reach out a hand. And it's sad to say that, honestly, but I don't have any faith or trust that if I'm going to help this person, they're going to do good afterward.
Right. Like, you would be helping them, almost enabling them.
Enabling them and making it worse.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really fair point. I do want to tie that into kind of the last topic of just faith in general, because I think I'm a very big optimist. I'm not going to say I've never been a pessimistic guy in my life, but I would say I try to keep optimism, and I have a hard time accepting when someone says there's no hope, there's no... But, you know, I come from a Christian background, and I had a really good experience with it, right? Mm-hmm. And I have seen repairs in relationships happen. I've seen all kinds of just trust repairs in general, almost near miracle experiences where you would have never thought that could have been repaired. Mm-hmm. But I think with faith, and I truly believe that it has to come from that faith mm-hmm. most of the time, that some of those repairs are possible. But with that, you know, I'd like to know a little bit about your kind of just your faith journey, and how you see God show up for you on a weekly basis.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll say I grew up Catholic, and my parents were very big on bringing us to church every Sunday growing up as kids. probably until I got through high school into college was when I really kind of stopped going to church. It wasn't a habit that I kept in place in my life mm-hmm. once I hit my 20s.
Right.
I will say, though, I don't want to say my relationship with God was distance for a bit, but there was definitely a point in my life where I don't really think I was even thinking about it. Mm-hmm. I related everything to just what was tangible.
Right.
Like, okay, this is happening, it's going well, it's because I'm doing it.
Right. And then, you know, that ties in too, like the opposite of that, the literal definition of faith is the belief in what is unseen.
Yes.
Right? And I think that's what's really hard, especially if you've had like a bad experience growing up in the church or just anything like that. I think it's really hard to trust, mm-hmm. to trust that to lead your daily life, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm a big believer that, and I was distant for a bit as well. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to lie about that. But I think it fluctuates for all people, right? But for me, the moment I decided that, whether it was, you know, church every Sunday or, you know, where I was going to do something consistent for God, with God, whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. after I went through the darkest time in my life. Because when I realized that nothing earthly was going to bring me out of this pit of disaster, I had nothing else to lean on but to lean on God, right? And I would say in my life, God showed up for me in a huge way. And one of those ways is giving me a friend like you, right? Mm-hmm. Giving me people that I can be surrounded by now that are, it's not surface level, it is strong bonds, strong relationships.
Mm-hmm. I think the biggest takeaway for me recently, and you've helped me with this, is getting to the understanding that some people believe everything, like give it up to God for everything. While I do want to believe that, part of me understands, like, you have to realize God made you mm-hmm. the way you are to capitalize on the opportunities that he's giving you.
Right. He gave you logic.
Yes.
He gave you reason. He gave you a brain to think with.
Yeah.
Kind of goes back to, like, just a quick example. During COVID, a lot of people had, they called it their faith, and I could see both sides of it, truly, but they said that, well, of course we're going to still go to church, even though everyone's got COVID going around, because why would God give us COVID if, you know, we're worshiping him? Mm-hmm. And then a lot of those churches, everyone got sick, and people had health issues and stuff like that,
yeah.
And I heard a pastor say one time, well, yeah, God gave you a brain as well to use mm-hmm. in situations like this. Mm-hmm. He gave you logic and reason to do that, and you didn't. So lesson learned, but and the intentions were probably really good.
Yeah.
But I think there's that level as well.
He also gave us free will.
Right.
So yeah, they could do what they want at the end of the day. And as long as you're going through your life knowing that, okay, I was given these opportunities, but it is on me to move forward with my own life. Mm-hmm. But understand that when you do that, you're opening yourself up to new adventures, new struggles that you're mm-hmm. not going to know what to do, and you have to lean back on your faith to know, okay, I can get through it because of what God has given me.
Right.
Not necessarily that God is going to pave the way for you to do everything. You still have to do it. But
he can open doors.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think
you still got to walk through the door.
Yeah. You still got to walk through the door. But I think for me, you know, I think everyone has to speak for themselves. I think this is one of those things where I don't think I've ever heard of any two faith journeys being identical. Mm-hmm. I think it's all about what's in your heart, what you believe, what you are willing to trust God with, what you're willing to trust any kind of faith with. Mm-hmm. Right. But I believe that it's important to have it regardless.
I agree. And I think the biggest thing I've learned as I've matured and grown, as a kid, I thought, oh, I need to just follow in the footsteps of my parents are doing. It's, this is their belief. This is what they do. Like, it's just the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. My faith and my relationship with God doesn't need to look like how my mom's is, how my dad's is, how my right. brothers are. But when it comes to your close friends and family, a lot of people want to just tie those things together and like, well, I want to be more like this I want to be more like this person, so I want to do what they're doing. Mm-hmm. When in reality, you have to be comfortable with whatever your relationship is with God and just know that it's okay to have a good day and a bad day every now and then. It's not always going to be sunshine and rainbows.
Before we end this episode, I would like to just ask you point blank, you know, if there's anyone out here listening, guy or girl, that has struggled with mental health stuff, has struggled with, you know, faith showing up in their life at all, or maybe consistently, with just anything that people might be going through, what's your final piece of advice for them?
It gets better. It gets better. You have to go through the tough times to appreciate the good times. Mm-hmm. And that may sound a little cliche, but it's true. I've been in very, I don't want to say dark times, but times where I'm not myself. I normally am a very outgoing, extroverted, confident person. There's moments in your life where things aren't going to go your way, and you're going to have a little bit of lack of faith in why, whether you believe in God or whatever higher power, you're going to sit there and question it and be like, well, how is this higher power real if I'm going through this really difficult time and this is what I'm supposed to deal with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it is.
And
it
that's
is.
Where faith comes in, right?
Yeah. And knowing that there's going to be a light at the end of the tunnel, and that tunnel might be longer than what you expected, but
right.
But you're going to get through it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you for that. Once again, Cam Wanick, everyone. Thank you so much, Cam, for being here.
Of course.
Appreciate you, brother. Love you, man.
Michael. Love you, man.
This episode is sponsored by Tin Can Timepieces. Looking for a watch that's built for anything life throws at you? Let me introduce you to Tin Can Timepieces. This is more than just a watch. It's a commitment to quality and purpose. Tin Can Timepieces is proudly based out of Georgia and is owned and operated by an active-duty U.S. Navy submariner. That's right. A company built on discipline and precision. Every watch they create is handcrafted and features reliable automatic movements, ensuring you get a premium quality feel with every tick. Whether you need a rugged diver or a classic dress watch, Tin Can offers an assortment of styles for every mission. Tin Can Timepieces, hand-built for purpose, built for the depths. Dive deeper and check out their collection today at tincantime.com.